This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, May 3rd, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening.
Retrocedo! Me rindo! Abandono! O avanzo con el pueblo!
And we begin today in Venezuela. As we've been reporting, that country is in the throes of another round of upheaval. Shortages of food and medical supplies have led to long lines at stores, widespread hunger in some areas, and mass protests against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Maduro said Monday he wants to rewrite the constitution in Venezuela, and opposition parties called it an attempt to delay elections and to neutralize dissent in the National Assembly and on the streets. Protests have intensified. At least 29 protesters have died in recent weeks. Meanwhile, many Venezuelans outside the country, of course, are deeply concerned about poor conditions and human rights abuses in their home country. Thousands of them live in and around Miami, right here in the United States, and local politicians there are getting involved. Miami-Dade County Commissioner Jose Diaz has called on the U.S. government to impose tougher sanctions on Maduro's government. The Trump administration, in its early days, already announced some sanctions against the vice president, Tariq Al-Aissami. They blocked him from financial dealings with the United States. But Commissioner Jose Diaz says more should be done. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you, Todd.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, it's not every day that a county commissioner in the United States gets involved in international sanctions. But why is this issue of Venezuela important to you? And more importantly, I guess, why is it important to your constituents?
Well, it's important to me as a person. I was privileged to come into this country when I was 2 years old. Thank God. From a country that lost all its democracy and lost all its way of being. And as to Venezuela, I see the amount of turmoil, the amount of murders that are being committed, a government that's gone haywire, a government that's gone against its own people and lost everything, stability. You know, they dropped their Congress. So it's a dictatorship that this person has taken place. As far as my community, I have the largest community of Venezuelans outside of Venezuela that live in a place in my district called Doral. It's a great city. A lot of them are American citizens, and some are not. But it's something that I am supportive of as a commissioner to help everybody that I possibly can.
Now, your senator from Florida, Marco Rubio, has pushed hard for sanctions in the Senate, and he continues to do that. So I know that he agrees with you on this. The Trump administration has exacted some sanctions on the vice president in Venezuela, but what more would you like to see in terms of practical sanctions here?
We need to put as many sanctions as we can. And the sanctions is basically to stop that dictator, to basically stop what they're doing. And also we have Congressman Cubero that also understands, and Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart. They're all on the same wavelength, understanding, because they come from that tyranny. And they just don't want to see it continue and people dying daily on the streets. And the worst part is they don't even have the freedom that we have here in this great country of ours. But they don't even can't go to a grocery store and buy a simple meal for their family or the medicines they need for their children. They don't have that right now because of such turmoil.
Well, all of that is true. And then it raises the question that I know you've thought through. Further ratcheting down on the Venezuelan economy, if there were more sanctions, risks further pain to the very people you're trying to help who can't go to the grocery store or get medical attention because there are no supplies.
I'm a Marine myself, and I will tell you that those people are so brave to get out there and just protest against those odds. I mean, think about it. They have all the weapons. They have all the machinery. They have everything they need. They have, like you said, they have that food, they have it, but then they turn around and squash their own people. They have nothing to lose. They just want this to stop. And I think this is the only way when you see some of these tyrants and some of these government officials, when all their stuff is put in a sanction or taken and put aside, these are things that they really worry about. So maybe that'll make the difference.
Jose Diaz is county commissioner in Miami-Dade County in South Florida. Commissioner Diaz, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, guys.
It's been nearly 20 years since Hugo Chavez and his Chavistas took hold in Venezuela. Chavez is gone now, of course, but how did this oil-rich country that was once the pride of Latin American development descend into this violence and instability that we're seeing now? Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez is adjunct lecturer of finance at Northwestern University. He's also a biweekly columnist for the Venezuelan newspaper El Nacional. Daniel, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us of what it was like back then when Chavez rose to power, promising to send billions into healthcare and education.
Chavez's rise was largely fueled by a particular moment in Latin America writ large's history, even more so than just Venezuela. You had had an economic crisis in the 1980s, and the 1990s you had a lot of what were called neoliberal reforms under the Washington Consensus. There was a lot of privatizations, a lot of social spending was cut, and Venezuela was hit particularly hard by this because the 1990s was also a period in which oil was very cheap. When Hugo Chavez was elected, oil was at $18 a barrel. He rose to prominence because the system that had been in place since the 1960s was a two-party system. Both parties competed against one another, but had become largely discredited as the economy did not pick up in the 90s. Each side had a chance to try and reform the economy and didn't manage to do so. Their popularity was very low. And Hugo Chavez came to power as a former participant or leader in a failed coup against one of these presidents who was able to channel his popularity as an outsider who had been against a system that a lot of Venezuelans now rejected and win power by electoral means. He came in with very large promises that he wasn't able to keep initially, but as oil rose in price, more money started coming into Venezuela than ever had before. And a lot of social programs were brought about, large prestige projects that spent a lot of this windfall. There was very little that had been saved. There had been debts that had been brought up. And that's what's brought us to the economic crisis that Venezuela sees now.
When you boil it down, Daniel, is it as simple as the price of oil tanking, Venezuela's bank going with it, and then all of this graft and mismanagement that you mentioned?
Well, there's a little more to it than that. The Venezuelan doctors one sees around the world are actually doctors who have left Venezuela seeking greener pastures. Cuba sends doctors around the world on government stipends, essentially, including Venezuela, which with Cuba has a oil for doctors program, which largely makes up for the flight of the trained medical practitioners in Venezuela proper.
Well, Daniel, you mentioned these Venezuelan doctors around the world, and it's just one small part of an enormous brain drain. What has that meant for the local economy in Venezuela and for its ability now to recover from the current crisis?
It has been a hugely important problem for Venezuela. People started leaving early on in Chavez's regime, largely because they felt that there was political persecution. For example, the oil industry, after a general strike, was purged of people who were seen, PDVSA, the state oil company, who were seen as opposing the government, and they now form the bedrock of Colombia's oil industry. But the loss of that educated class, I think, might actually represent an important opportunity for Venezuela moving forward. This crisis is probably not quite at its apogee, but it's not too far away. And a transition will come in the near to mid future. When it does, that generation of educated Venezuelans who now have foreign connections, foreign capital, can be a real bedrock to helping the Venezuelan economy recover and potentially diversify it away from oil, which would help shield it from the what are otherwise predictable effects of the boom-bust cycle that Chavez missed.
Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez, adjunct lecturer of finance at Northwestern University and a columnist for El Nacional in Venezuela. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just days after President Trump was inaugurated, he sat down with the heads of the big three auto manufacturers, urging them to build more cars here in the United States. Now, outsourcing is just one problem facing auto workers. Many of them point to automation as a bigger threat, and of course, good old-fashioned supply and demand. The most recent numbers coming from automakers yesterday point to a decline in sales, the first decline after seven straight years of growth. Trump's message is still powerful, and it resonated with auto workers who helped him win in Michigan. WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter has more.
In the heat of the presidential campaign last year, then-candidate Donald Trump made a vow that still echoes among car companies and the auto workers who eventually helped propel him into the Oval Office. Trump said if the Ford Motor Company made good on plans to open a new factory in Mexico, he, as president, would impose as much as a 35% tax on any products made south of the border but sold in the U.S.
Within 24 to 48 hours, I will get a call from the head of Ford, and he will say, Mr. President, we have decided that we will build our new plant in the United States.
Trump's timetable was a bit off, but Trump did get that call from the head of Ford.
I called him before we made the decision to inform him that we were doing that, and I, have a dialogue with him.
Bill Ford Jr. chairs the motor company that bears his family's name. He says market forces drove Ford to scrap a facility planned in Mexico while adding jobs in Michigan, not pressure from the president.
Not at all. I mean, look, we made our own decision. We have to make our own decisions. We have to do what's right for our shareholders, and we will. But he's obviously very interested in jobs in America, and that's great. And so I'm happy to have the relationship I do with him.
Yet Trump took credit for Ford and other automakers adding new jobs in the U.S., whether or not the companies already had those plans in the works.
Okay, cool. Happy New Year.
And that message resonated among blue-collar workers here in Michigan's Macomb County, a part of the Detroit metropolitan region, where voters tipped the state towards Trump and in a very real way helped propel him into the White House.
You know, all these job shops, when I was a kid, they were thriving.
In the parking lot of a convenience store, painter Lou Sacco looks grimly at a sales slip, noting that the economy has grown increasingly tight for many in Macomb County. He says the area depended on auto jobs that simply are not there anymore.
Now, you know, these American parts are made in other countries, and you know, I just don't see that coming back.
But he says he applauds Trump for trying.
I think if anybody can, it's Trump. You know, I think he will make an effort to bring some of the companies back.
A bit further down the parking lot, Fiat Chrysler worker Elsie Martinez gives Trump and his push to bring auto jobs back to the U.S. a big league thumbs up.
I love it. I love it. Americans, we shop here. We do our jobs here. We need to keep our money here. We can't compete with people that can work for a dollar a day.
But experts say traditional auto workers don't simply face competition from their low-cost counterparts in other countries. They're being challenged by something increasingly present in their own home factories, robots and other automation.
At its peak in June of 2000, Michigan's auto industry employed 333,000 workers, 29% of the nation's 1.2 million auto jobs. By 2015, that number of auto jobs had dropped to less than half of the peak. President Trump vowed to bring back those auto jobs to the United States and to make Michigan, in particular, the manufacturing hub of the entire globe. Some analysts question if today's auto workers will be ready for an increasingly technological future, however. In part two of this report, WDET's Quinn Kleinfelter talks with auto workers whose traditional assembly line jobs are losing ground to automation.
Even before officially taking charge of the Oval Office, President-elect Trump maintained a Twitter barrage citing plans from Ford and Fiat Chrysler to invest millions of dollars and create thousands of jobs in Michigan and Ohio as proof that his brand of tough economic love is working.
The word is now out that when you want to move your plant to Mexico or some other place and you want to fire all of your workers from Michigan and Ohio and all these places that I won, it's not going to happen that way anymore.
But Mexico's economy minister says don't blame his country. Ildefonso Guajardo recently told Detroit business executives he was ready to negotiate revising the North American Free Trade Agreement with President Trump with the understanding that it's automation, not Mexico, that U.S. auto workers truly must deal with.
Fighting for 700 jobs will not make a difference. It's how we are going to readapt, redesign our training process to face together the challenges of the technological revolution.
For the head of the United Auto Workers Union, that means one thing.
Robots, right?
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
UAW President Dennis Williams says U.S. auto workers are in something of a battle against the R2D2s of the car world and in need of a national industrial policy that helps employees learn new skills.
That's why education has to get back to not only the academic part of education, but also the vocational and the apprenticeship part. You got to have a skill level in a country to maintain industrial bases and technology.
The auto industry of the future is on display at an educational event hosted by the group Junior Achievement of Southeastern Michigan. Hundreds of high schoolers filter between exhibits featuring car companies and recruiters touting jobs they say pay auto workers well, if not exactly CEO-level salaries.
Does it pay good? Are they all driving Ferraris? No, because they work at GM. Why would they drive Ferraris?
But building these high-tech car parts being shown off demands that workers know something about advanced technology. The director of engineering for global car interior design company Forcia, Elizabeth Griffith, says the days of assembly line workers making part after part are rapidly dwindling. Robots, she says, work faster and more efficiently without requiring vacations or sick days.
So you will not have the huge workforce that we've had in the past. Technology has moved on. With autonomous vehicles and everything else going on, you will not have that luxury in the future, okay, because you just can't.
Griffith says her company actually fostered some apprenticeship programs to try and create the kind of skilled workforce it needs. But she says convincing auto workers to adapt to the new normal of manufacturing can be a tough sell, even in her own household.
I come from a blue-collar family. I grew up in Detroit. My dad worked in the automotive industry. My brother works in the automotive industry currently, UAW. I'm married to a UAW member. So it's very controversial sometimes in our family. But you have to look at, are they willing to be retrained? And a lot of cases, they will flat out tell you, no, I can't do that.
Yet, it's a reality workers contend with daily back in Macomb County, a part of the Detroit metropolitan region, at factories like this Chrysler assembly plant in the city of Warren. It's shift change at the plant, and 18-year veteran maintenance worker Mike Nicholson says he's sure his job will be there when he returns the next day, robots or not.
People on the line get replaced with robots, but they can't really replace maintenance guys with robots. So, yeah, it's unfortunate for who if you're on the line.
For worker Christopher Cavaretta, increased automation actually provides an opportunity. There's even a term for it, cobots, humans working side by metallic side with robots.
Well, you just got to get the right knowledge to learn how to work the robots, then you'll be fine, right? but that could be a problem for people, you know, the working class. Well, I'm fine because I got multiple streams of income. I do real estate, too, so.
But auto workers like 23-year-old Frederick Miller say the assembly plant offers a decent, if physical, job for now.
I think it's not for everybody. Yeah, we had a guy go to the emergency for some of the jobs here. It's not for me, not for the rest of my life. I think I can do something better than this. I'm still young.
The U.S. auto industry has proven extremely resilient, posting record profits only a few years after two of Detroit's big three automakers required a federal financial bailout to stay afloat. But the question remains whether the auto workers of today will seek the new skills necessary to remain relevant in the company's increasingly automated future, or if they will look elsewhere as the auto jobs of the past continue to fade away. For The Takeaway, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Our kids' health, you know, the fact that we have really made big strides to change the health of our kids, especially through the school lunch program, which I hope does not get touched, because that makes sense. So we have to keep doing things that make sense for our future.
Well, that, of course, is Michelle Obama. She's talking with Jimmy Fallon in January there about the legacy of one of her signature achievements as First Lady, comprehensive reform of school nutrition. The reforms that Michelle Obama helped implement included the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. Now, on Monday, recently confirmed Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue announced the Trump administration's plan to, and I'm not kidding here, make school lunches great again. The plan is to roll back some of the requirements on things like sweetened milk, sodium, and whole grains in cafeteria lunches for kids. Margo Wootan is Director of Nutrition Policy at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Margo, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's great to be here.
What was your reaction when you saw that same press release that I did, make school meals great again?
I couldn't believe that they were using that campaign tagline to describe rolling back school nutrition standards. They're actually proposing steps that are going to make school lunches more unhealthy, to roll back the tremendous amount of progress that schools have been making towards serving healthier food to kids.
Now, there are some standards proposed on whole grains. A lot of advocates have said they're not terribly different, but let's talk about sodium. Sodium is an additive with very real health consequences on blood pressure, heart disease. How are the proposals changing standards on sodium for kids' food?
What the Trump administration is proposing is locking in dangerously high levels of sodium in school lunches. Schools have been working to gradually reduce the amount of sodium over time. They've done the first phase of sodium reduction. What they're doing is preventing the next level of sodium reduction from going into effect.
Flavored milk is another area where some of the rules might be relaxed. You know, one of the arguments here, Margo, is that a little extra sugar to make milk more delicious, chocolate milk, strawberry milk, might be worth it to get more calcium into the kids.
I'm not as concerned about the chocolate milk provision because it's not like they're adding chocolate milk into schools and it doesn't exist. What they're saying is, in addition to schools being able to serve fat-free chocolate milk, they also can serve 1% chocolate milk.
Margo, one of the key arguments here is that it's fine to have standard, it's great to have rules, but you can't force people to eat something they don't like. And a lot of kids just pass up healthier food, and the standards don't work because they'll just get a saltier snack somewhere else, or they'll choose a food that has the sodium that they crave.
This administration is known for its alternative facts, and this is a place where the administration just isn't getting it right. Kids like the new school meals generally. I mean, not every single kid, right? Of course, kids complain about school lunch. They complained about school lunch when it was unhealthy. Studies show that there is no more food waste and that kids are actually eating more fruits and vegetables now than they did before these updated nutrition standards went into effect.
Margo, some advocates have called these changes that you and I are talking about sort of relatively minor, but they warn that much bigger battles are ahead, like vending machines selling junk food in schools or even fruit and vegetable standards on the kids' tray. It seems like things are about to get way more heavy than they are now.
It's really discouraging that in, you know, just the first few days of his tenure, one of the first things that the Secretary of Agriculture does is to roll back progress on the quality of school meals served to children. We hope that this is all they're going to do around school food, but we will be ready and watching and working to defend the progress on healthy school meals.
Margo Wu-Tan, Director of Nutrition Policy at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
I approach it really that it's America first for national security and economic prosperity. And that doesn't mean it comes at the expense of others. Our partnerships and our alliances are critical to our success in both of those areas.
That's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson there addressing State Department staff today in a section of D.C. called Foggy Bottom at State Department headquarters. It's his first time talking to employees there since assuming his post in February. Now, Tillerson is addressing thousands of people nervous for their jobs and uncertain about the future of their mission at the State Department. The Trump administration has called for deep cuts. They've proposed a 31% reduction in the budget at the State Department and at USAID. Tillerson responded to his boss. Says he's proposing to eliminate 2,300 jobs. That's about 3% of the workforce. Now, Congress will ultimately decide the funding levels here, but state appears to be operating on fumes right now. Many political positions are yet to be filled, and career staff are anxious about the future. Rob Bershinsky is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the Obama administration. He's also Senior Vice President of Policy for Human Rights First. Rob, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What are you hearing from your friends and colleagues, career people inside the State Department about the state of things right now?
Well, I think there's a lot of apprehension. People in the State Department feel marginalized. There are a number of different issues going on that are all kind of combining to lead to just a tremendous amount of uncertainty. You've got an administration that to be generous, has flip-flopped on a number of foreign policy issues such that the career staff have very little sense of what day-to-day policy is like. They've got a boss who has largely sequestered himself into the seventh floor, kind of the executive headquarters of the State Department. Not much guidance is flowing down to the worker bees.
You say flip-flops on key policy areas. Sounds like things like the president ran and said NATO is obsolete. Now he thinks NATO is important. He said it's okay if the South Koreans have nukes. Now he says we'd never allow it. Things like that that seem to be all over the map.
That's right. The issue for diplomats is their credibility when they're dealing with our foreign counterparts depends on that foreign counterpart believing what our diplomatic corps says. So when they don't even know where their own bosses are on a certain policy, that removes all sense of legitimacy and essentially makes it impossible for them to do their jobs.
Every administration has their own priorities, of course. Be honest, is State a department that could use some cuts, that could be more efficient, that could be leaner?
I think it's appropriate for every organization when new leadership comes in for that leadership to undertake a review, see what works, see what doesn't work. The State Department is no exception to that rule. The problem is what happened in this case is essentially the first word that came out of President Trump and Secretary Tillerson is that they felt it was appropriate to lop off roughly 30% of the State Department's budget in a time in which the world doesn't lack for any number of really complex diplomatic challenges. So now we have Secretary Tillerson saying, I'm going to go on a listening tour and better understand my department. The problem is he put the cart before the horse. He announced these massive, massive cuts while admitting that he doesn't fully understand even the nature of what the work of his employees is all about.
Hundreds of political positions unfilled at State, not because the Senate is slow. Most of these people have not been nominated by President Trump. One suspicion in Washington is that these political positions have been left unfilled intentionally so that there aren't very many people standing in the way when Secretary Tillerson, President Trump, the White House, and the budget cutters come for their cuts.
So the best I can say on that point is that because there's so little guidance flowing down from the senior leadership to the staff, rumors abound. What you just described in terms of this being intentional is one rumor. It may or may not be the correct one. What I am confident Secretary Tillerson will come to understand over time is that America needs a foreign policy. We remain the world's leader in terms of guiding essentially every issue out across the world. Without the key senior staff that the State Department relies upon, key ambassadors, assistant secretaries, the people that lead a policy on each region of the world, the United States is going to fall behind. Other countries are going to fill that gap. Very much works to the long-term detriment of the United States to leave these positions open.
Rob Rushinsky, thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Rob Rushinsky is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights in the Obama administration. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today.
One time I had brought a BB gun into class and a bunch of other kids started looking up to me, like all the little bad kids, you know, like all the little knuckleheads. They're like, oh man, that guy's cool, you know, we should hang out with him. And then some gang member approached us and started chilling with us, you know, like he kind of told us that we wanted to join, that we'll be promised money, drugs, and protection. I did make a lot of money, like off selling drugs and stuff like that, but it wasn't really getting me new clothes, new shoes. I was just helping my mom pay bills at first. And she kind of questioned about where I get the money. And I had to be truthful about it because, like, my mom was the only person I used to go to and talk to about things, you know. And she kind of understood what I had to go through, you know, as a boy growing up. And, you know, in this area, the way it is. At the same time, like, I wish you would have put a stop to me or, like, spanked me for selling drugs, you know, because, like, these guys were doing, like, killing people, actually. Like, I was witnessing these people, like, these grown men killing guys. And, like, I was supposed to be the ride-along, you know, like I'm supposed to ride along with these guys, watch them kill somebody, so next time I come, I know how to kill somebody.
Someone is shot in Chicago every other hour. And that's the title of a new series from our friends at WBEZ. Every Other Hour looks at the roots and the realities of gun violence in Chicago. We played you the story of Jaime, a former gang member, yesterday on the show. Today, we bring you Alex's story. We heard a few moments ago about how Alex, when he was just a young boy, was trained to kill. And we pick up his story here.
The first time I actually saw, I hit somebody with a bullet, like, intentionally, like, was when I was 13 years old. And I was actually with a bunch of friends, and we were game banging on my block, you know. And every time you game bang, you have your leader and you have the second ranking officer. The ranking officer from my block, you know, he gave me his gun as me being his bodyguard, you know. So I took the gun. I mean, as a little kid, I really didn't know how to use a gun. So I just like, okay. So I guess I got in the gangway. I was in the darkened area, you know, with a hoodie over my head. And I was just watching every car pass by, you know, like as a real security guard. So like about an hour into being in the gangway, I seen a car pull up, and these guys started hollering out the window asking for weed, if we had weed for sale. And one of my friends walked up to the car not knowing that it was actually a rival gang trying to trick us. Once my friend like walked up to the car, on the opposite side of the car, a door opened. So that's when I jumped up. I had the gun right next to my pocket, you know, in my hoodie pocket. And as soon as the guy jumped out the car, he charged at us with a bat, not knowing that I had a gun on me. So I pulled it out, and I was aiming for his chest. That's all I remember, was aiming for his chest. And I squeezed the trigger about 4 or 5 times, striking him in the chest. It was a .45 caliber. It was pretty heavy. And as soon as I pulled the trigger once, like, the gun, like, it jerked my shoulder back from all that power that it probably had. But after that, like, I felt a little bit, like, I don't know, like, hyped up, like, you know, like, damn, you know, I just shot my first gun, you know. He was hospitalized, and he came out in good condition after that. After, I think, about a week being hospitalized. I got caught by the cops with the gun, so I ended up catching the case, you know, with the attempted murder. I did about, actually, like, 3 years. A lot of friends, like, were like, I mean, they were boasting about me, like, saying, free me, you know, all this good stuff on Facebook, MySpace, actually, back then. And when I got out, I mean, I got hit with, like, with drugs and money as a, like, as an award for what I did. But in the long run, it kind of just affected my lifestyle. It kind of, like, messed up my head being in them cells for so long and just sitting there thinking about, like, what I had done. Because just sitting in jail replays the same crime you did over and over and over. So, like, kind of mentally messes you up. My friend was, like, all into school. Like, he was all for it. Like, he just tried to do the same thing that I was trying to do, get out the gang life. And on his 18th birthday, he ended up getting killed. And when that happened, it kind of, like, brought me back into my old ways, into, like, being a crazy guy, you know, like, doing bad things. Like, I was trying to change myself. I was in Malcolm X getting my GED. I was going to welding school, and I was doing so good. I had a job. I wasn't going to my hood for a year and a half. And you not showing your face around the block, it's consequences, you know. It's called the SOS, smash on sight, you know. Like, when they catch you, they beat you, you know. So I guess that's what I had coming for not being around for a year and a half. So the day my friend got killed, I decided to go back to my hood and take a two-minute beatdown from all my guys, you know. After the beatdown, I told my friends, like, I need a gun. They gave me a gun, and I called my close friend that I trust, and he came and picked me up, and he brought his close friend that he trusted, and he had his own gun, so it was going to be two of us that jumped out and did what we did. We rode around by the rival gang members. We were going around the blocks four or five times until we found some guy in a wheelchair sitting on top of his porch steps with five other guys with black hoodies over their head. So we're like, man, these guys surely look like they gang bang. And sure enough, these guys were like throwing gang signs at us. So we're like, all right, cool. You know, these guys are definitely the guys you're going to try to kill. So we decided to go around the whole house. You know, like we went in front of the house and we approached these guys. And my friend was the first one to fire the shots, you know. So he let like three shots go. And I was waiting for somebody like with a gun to like shoot back. That was my whole like instinct, like to wait to see who's the shooter from their side, you know. And I guess nobody had a gun, so that's when I started like shooting at them. And I mean, we all missed, but I still got caught. Like, I'm pretty much gonna be doing 4 years anytime soon. But I'm on house arrest just to get this extra time, you know, as counted for. We're going to try to file motion for suppress evidence. But, I mean, all in all, like, I'm actually just going to take my whole consequences that I got to deal with, you know, because I'm not going to sit here and lie to the judge and say that I didn't have a gun, you know, when I knew what I was going to do. I mean, the things that we do, like, when we go retaliate, it is a bad thing, you know, like, but people just don't know why we do the shooting. Like, there's a story behind why we shoot people, you know? I mean, I understand innocent bystanders are getting hit, and I don't approve of that, you know? Like, innocent people dying because of these dumb people that want to shoot. But, like, sometimes, like, there's a big story behind why the guy shot him, you know? Or why the guy wants to shoot somebody. It's about whose gang's the toughest, actually, or what gang got the most kills, you know? It's like, who dies the fastest, you know?
Alex spoke with WBEZ's Patrick Smith for this story. Our thanks to WBEZ for sharing these stories. You can check out their full series and all the incredible work they're doing on gun violence in Chicago by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. We live in a country and a culture where military veterans are revered and at the same time often ignored when it comes to the realities of combat and life after combat. Volunteers in war, of course, sometimes pay with their lives, but more often they return home with severe and disabling physical or mental injuries. Now, those disabilities often last a lifetime, and the task of caring for disabled veterans can fall to loved ones who suddenly find themselves working around the clock as caregivers with little to no training. There is, of course, a new wave of young disabled veterans returning home after wars in Iraq and the ongoing war in Afghanistan. Bobby O'Brien is a reporter and producer covering veterans and military affairs for WUSF Public Media in Florida. She's also a correspondent for the American Homefront Project, and she's been reporting on military caregivers and their families.
Hidden heroes are what they're called. It's the spouses or family members of a lot of the post-9/11 veterans who were there caring for their loved ones. They were not being noticed. Their needs were being pushed to the side by the caregivers themselves, because that is one of the many symptoms of a military veteran caregiver. They put themselves last.
And what are some of the needs of these caregivers? I mean, certainly they must be financial. Certainly they must be time and emotional input. But from the outside, it might be hard to conceive about what some of the needs of veteran caregivers really are.
A RAND study done in 2014 found that there were 5.5 million veteran and military caregivers. Of those, more than a million were for post-9/11 veterans. So that means you have a lot younger caregiver who might be in their 20s or 30s looking at a lifetime of being a caregiver, everything from working with someone who might be a quadriplegic to someone who might have traumatic brain injury. They tend to have to deal with mental health and substance abuse, usually not connected to a support network, and they're likely to not know about the resources and services that are there for them. I had the advantage of talking with a family who has been dealing with it for 10 years.
I'm not bitter about anything that's happened to me. This whole thing is just, it's life. What has happened is just life. So by me being where I'm at now, I was able to spend more time than most fathers ever would get to spend with their kids.
Ken Catter was in the Army. He suffered not one but two exposures to an IED and still remained in country for 5 months. His wife noticed the immediate difference in him when he came home. He was diagnosed with traumatic brain injury. When this happened, their children were in elementary school. So Patty Catter, his wife, could not possibly pull them out of school every time she needed to take her husband to a doctor's appointment, so she homeschooled them.
What does Patty say to you about the unexpected, about the burden that she now faces? I mean, I suppose a military spouse is always somewhere in the back of their mind prepared for the idea that their spouse might not come home, but maybe not prepared for the idea that they may come home, but come home not the person they were.
That is exactly verbatim almost what she said. She was prepared for him to not come home because it was a rather rough deployment for Ken and his unit. But she was not prepared for him coming home changed the way he was. He has 100% disability, but that doesn't change having a husband who is a delightful individual, but yet can't help balance the checkbook, can't manage the household affairs. So she is running a household. She's raising the kids. She was carrying that whole burden. And she finally was in a really dark place because she was worried about what she'd heard about traumatic brain injury and its long-term consequences.
We're hearing rumors about things like Alzheimer's. We're hearing rumors about Parkinson's disease and all these different things that can be connected to brain injury. And it scared the daylights out of me because I couldn't picture my husband having to go through that.
You know, politicians from Congress to the White House tend to fall over each other to throw money at veterans programs. And I wonder, apart from this foundation, whether the VA or the government more broadly has recognized spousal care and family care of injured veterans as a problem, and whether real support, taxpayer support, is available here.
The VA has recognized it after Congress passed a bill saying they needed to address the caregivers. And there is a program. Initially, they thought 4,000 would qualify. Within the first 3 years, they had, I believe, about 15,000 sign up and qualify. The VA underestimated what was needed, and then they were overwhelmed. And now Congress is looking at possibly with the new VA secretary, Dr. Shulkin. He has said, yes, he's in favor of expanding it beyond the post-9/11 veterans.
Bobby O'Brien is correspondent for the American Homefront Project and a reporter and producer covering veterans and military affairs for WUSF. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
And while we let you go here, it's World Press Freedom Day today. The message here from Antonio Guterres, United Nations Secretary General: I call for an end to all crackdowns against journalists because a free press advances peace and justice for all. Well, we want to thank you for your ongoing support of journalists here at The Takeaway and everywhere. We think what we do matters, and it just isn't possible without you. Remember, you can always join our conversation at 8778-MYTAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo, working to help businesses of any size create customized business cards, postcards, stickers, and more. Learn more at Moo.com. Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA believes smart financial decisions should enable life, not define it. TIAA calls this the new success story. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.